Hi, this is Brooke Devard from Naked Beauty. Are you tired of feeling housebound? I sure am. Break free with the new Unbound Cordless Auto Curler from Conair. It's a high-performance auto curler that's rechargeable and gives you up to 60 minutes of cord-free runtime. Just think of all of the incredible hair looks you can create in 60 minutes, unbound, away from your wall. Don't get tied down by cords. Love your look. Live unbound. Check it out at conair.com and search unbound.
Because I think you have to believe in yourself. And actually, I know you have to believe in yourself and believe that every catch is possible to make, right? Just like every business deal, if you believe in it, it's possible to get done. Any relationship is possible to succeed in. And if you don't believe in that, then you probably shouldn't be doing what you're doing.
Hello, my friends. Welcome to another episode of The Genie Show. I love that you tune in each and every week to listen to the stories that are told from my guests and the valuable lessons and nuggets of wisdom that they share about cultivating happiness in your life. There's so many values that they bring up each and every week, and this week is no different. My guest today is Jeff Van Note. He's a mortgage professional and fellow podcast host. And what I particularly enjoyed about this episode was how he talked about knowing your strengths. You know, in our life where we're constantly critiquing ourselves and being critiqued by others, it's very easy to fall into the trap of just focusing on what we're not good at, what we can improve on, what we can do better. And that's obviously a great mindset and attitude to have, but it's also equally important, if not more important, to also focus on your strengths. Having that self-awareness to know what you're good at, what you can improve on, and what you're not so good at, that is great power that you hold. That means that no one can say to you, hey, you're a really, really bad project manager. You can be like, yeah, I know. It's not my skill set. This is why I delegate to other people, and this is why I focus on other things. So being strong and being empowered in your skills and your strengths, and also knowing what you're not so good at, that is a great tool to have in your toolbox. So today's guest is Jeff Van Note, and he talks about knowing your strengths. Jeff Van Note, welcome to The Genie Show. Thank you for joining me today.
I'm super excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Jeff, there's so many things that you put out on social media. You're like an energizer bunny. Like, I'm like, how is this guy driving and giving advice on real estate? It's fantastic. You have an amazing work ethic. I'm actually curious to know. I want to kind of break down your mentality about certain things. One thing that I've discovered about you working with you in a short time is you're very aware of what you're really good at and what you're not really good at. How did you come to that level of self-awareness?
Pretty loaded question.
To start off with, yeah. This is a Genie Show. We get right into it.
Right. So I feel like being self-aware is, first of all, probably the most important thing you want to be as a person individually. And then also when you're in the real world, business world. At a young age, I had to realize what my strengths were and what my weaknesses were in order to succeed. You know, starting in the mortgage business at age 20 in December 2007, I had no real life experience, right?
Wow.
So I knew my strength was going out and meeting people, and I knew my weakness was paperwork, right?
Right.
Reviewing paperwork that really didn't matter at the end of the day, or collecting a pay stub when I already had tax returns. So I always had to try and find a way to be able to do more business, especially as, you know, profitability was shrinking naturally as a, you know.
Yeah.
It was just called margin compression. And you always have to hire somebody to like handle what you're not good at if you're the breadwinner. So that's kind of how I just became aware of like, hey, I know I'm really good at this and I'm going to focus on doing this. And it's not that I'm terrible at something else. I just know that my time is not best spent doing that.
Right. So you kind of figured that out at an early age, yeah. And obviously how you had to manage your business that way and how paperwork was coming in. When you kind of came to that realization, did you judge yourself for it? Or were you like, I'm just not good at this?
So I've never played this. I'm definitely my most tough critic.
Right.
Like I beat myself up more so when I was younger than now. Now, yeah. You know, my only real priority is being a father.
Right.
You know, my son comes first, right? Yeah. And I'm tough as a critic on that, but it's my first go around. So I've let up a little bit on that.
Right.
I learned a lot in my 20s. You know, my 10-12 year run in the mortgage business, I learned more. I would say comparing apples to apples more than anybody in America for that age, at least, right?
Yeah.
Even 40 and 50 year olds. It really wasn't about judging. I was just like, hey, I'm very good at some things, right? And at the end of the day, you have to kind of weigh out what you're very good at and what you're not good at. And then you fall somewhere in between for a success rate. So if I'm the best at meeting people and talking to them and getting them to give me business, the best, a 10 out of 10, but I'm a 2 out of 10 at collecting paperwork and follow up and dealing with the neediness, well, you know, that averages out to about a 6, plus or minus, right?
Yeah.
So that was still better than average. It was better than 50%.
Right.
And they say in Major League Baseball, like if you bat 300, where if you get a hit 3 out of 10 times,
right,
which is 30%, you're going to the Hall of Fame. As long as I'm above 30% in things, I'm okay with that. I'm still going to try and go to the Hall of Fame.
That process of auditing yourself, and this is kind of what I find fascinating about people, because it seems like, I mean, you've made it clear you are your own self-critic, and I think people can fall into that self-critic role quite a lot and criticize themselves more than other people would. But I'm curious to know too, you know, that auditing of, okay, I'm good at this, I'm not so good at this, it comes from a level, I think, of self-esteem or confidence that, you know, you obviously instilled in yourself, or maybe your parents did. What do you think impacted that in you?
I definitely don't think it was my parents.
Yeah.
You know, I think it comes from within.
Yeah.
And I could tell you that I'm the first person to laugh at myself.
Right? Right.
So when things happen and I'm the first person to know my decision or know my mistake or know I made a mistake or know I did something wrong, I'm already giving myself the A to Z critique of it, right?
Right.
So by the time somebody like takes a shot at me or critiques me, I'm onto 7 other things, and I'm like, yeah, you're old news, you know. But I just being real with yourself, you know. Yeah. If you want to continuously improve, they always say, like, you know, you really need to increase your weaknesses, you know, really focus on your weaknesses, make those better. I'm like, no, that's not right. I'm like, you know, if I have to speak Spanish, I can't speak Spanish. I'm not going to spend 2 years learning Spanish, because what if in 2 years you don't need Spanish?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And those are just things that I think helped me out along the way. But it was definitely something that was learned, and it's definitely something obviously that came from inside. I wanted to make sure that I did everything as perfect as possible. And if it wasn't perfect, I gave it my best of my ability, and I was only rated a 2 out of 10.
Wow.
That's what it was.
It's fantastic. Are there any experiences that shape that force you to look within to be able to kind of cultivate that kind of mentality? Digging deep here, Jeff.
Yeah, I think, you know, I got chills. You see my hair stand. I think sports really do provide to be a catalyst for that. You just have to be real with yourself, you know. And I was a quarterback initially. Well, actually, I was a lineman, and I was a turn quarterback, and then I turned running back, and then wide receiver, right? And I always said, it's never the quarterback's fault if my hand touched the ball. So even if I jumped up and tried to make like a circus catch, right, and I dropped it, but it was a tough catch, it would have been tough, I would have been like, damn it, I should have caught that, right? Now, should I have caught that? Listen, probably not, right? Like the law of physics say, you know, based on this trajectory and angle, you know, and your hand length and size, no, there's no way you would have caught it. But I'm like, well, all right, well, I should have been able to do it. Because I think you have to believe in yourself. And actually, I know you have to believe in yourself and believe that every catch is possible to make, right? Just like every business deal, if you believe in it, it's possible to get done. Any relationship is possible to succeed in. And if you don't believe in that, then you probably shouldn't be doing what you're doing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right on there. Right on. I'm curious to know too, because, you know, sports have formed that kind of mentality or mindset for you. And I think, you know, it's very easy to correlate sports into real life, especially when it comes to team building skills and that kind of thing. And also being aware of other people around. I'm also wondering too, do you have a morning routine, Jeff? And if you do, what is it?
It's actually funny. So I do, but I don't. I'm the most structured, unstructured person you'll ever meet, if that makes sense.
Makes sense.
Like, and the mortgage business actually molded me to be that way. It molded me to be adaptable, right? So let's say I have 10 things that I have to get done in a day. As long as those 10 things get done in the time that I wake up to the time I go to bed, I'm fine.
Yeah.
I don't care. Obviously, you know, I wake up. So usually now that my son's 10 months and he wants to play at 6:20 in the morning every day. Today he slept till 7:30, which is great. But he wakes up and he just starts hitting me like, hey, wake up. It's time to wake up. So it kind of speeds things up as far as the day goes.
Right.
When I broke my ankle last August, I started meditating. I first started meditating for everyone else's safety around me.
Right.
But it actually was a blessing in disguise and actually molded me to be the person that, you know, I'm sitting here today talking about. All right. So when I first wake up in the morning, if I wake up at 6:20, let's say, play around with my son in bed for like 10 minutes, And then he gets up and goes and does what he has to do with his mother. And I usually meditate for anywhere from an hour and a half to 3 hours every morning when I wake up.
Wow. An hour and a half to 3 hours.
Yeah. Every morning. And depending on the nighttime, so let's say I only get an hour and a half in the morning, I'll make up for that either with like a mid-afternoon siesta, they call it, like from 4 to 5, depending on my schedule on that day.
Right, right.
Or on the weekend.
Yeah.
Or at night before bed. So I meditate for a minimum 3 hours every day.
That's brilliant. Also, like, I find it hard to meditate for more than a certain amount of minutes sometimes. Mm-hmm. How did you get to the stage? It's like gym training, because it's a muscle you have to constantly practice, but you got it the is. 3 hours.
Yes, yeah, it wow. is. So I believe it's trial and error.
Right. Right.
And I believe if you want something bad enough, you have to figure out yourself and what you need in order to get there. So, like, I'm a big energy person. I've always been a big energy person, but I didn't know I was an energy person, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
like,
that makes sense.
I always picked up on people's vibes and energy.
Right.
I knew, like, I like the person or I don't like that person, but I didn't know it was correlated to vibe and energy. I just knew, like, something about them I liked or didn't like, or, like, they were full of crap or they weren't full of crap, right? But again, when I broke my ankle, I really, like, dug deep inside spiritually and, like, kind of figured out meanings of, like, why things are happening. Like, okay, my son's being born in 2 weeks. I just broke my ankle. I just had plates and screws put in. I can't walk. I need to find another, you know, brain activity, because if you're laying on the couch, and I was laid up for about 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks straight with a newborn son upstairs crying every day, living on my girlfriend's parents' couch at the time, being a 31-year-old that runs 4 businesses that generates 100% of the income for those businesses, being out of commission for that time frame, mentally really put a lot of fear in me. Fear and anxiety, it's definitely like the root of it will cause to do it. But when I get into my meditation, I, like, for example, let's say my lower back's tight because I worked out the day before, I'll literally go to YouTube and search, like, meditate lower back pain, or, like, meditate muscle relaxation, or whatever the case is, meditate headache relief. And that meditation, I usually try and make the first one between, like, 15 and 30 minutes on YouTube. And once I go through that 15 or 30 minutes, my body and mind will tell me, like, hey, you need more or you need less, right?
Right.
Sometimes I'll just get up and go. But more often than not, it leads into, like, another segue into another type of meditation. So, like, once I cured my lower back pain, for example, or, like, limited the amount of, like, tension and, like, swelling around it,
right,
naturally through meditating,
yeah,
it'll take me into another thing that I'm interested in. So I'm super interested in, like, the mind and body connection, and meditation really allows me to hit, like, the subconscious part of it.
Is that really the only part of the day where you find that you're completely still? Because I feel that you're always moving and I see your stories. You're always in a car and you're creating content. You're capitalizing on your time.
Am I still? It's funny. So you should be, like, meditating, laying on your back, sitting up. I definitely roll over a couple times. I try my best to lay on my back and be flat and, like, really get the full experience out of it. It probably is the only time that I'm still for that length of time. Obviously, other than sleep. But even in sleep, like, you're not really sleeping.
Yeah.
So probably.
Wow. Okay. Thank you for sharing that. So meditation is kind of like your non-negotiable for every day.
Yeah.
You,
like,
do.
No ifs, ands, or buts. Like, I don't care what you have to do. Like, this is what I have to do. Again, for my well-being, but for everyone else's safety.
What I find interesting about that too, Jeff, is I ask this question a lot about what people's morning routines are, because I feel that there are certain habits that people cultivate to create happiness. And what's unique about yours is you kind of didn't really say that you had a routine, but you had one non-negotiable that you needed to do to ground yourself for your well-being and the well-being of others, from what you explained. So thank you for sharing that. I'm wondering too, you know, talking about the topic of happiness, you've clearly gone all in on your strengths. You've really taken a Gary Vee type, like, mentality of going all your strengths, your weaknesses, outsource to other people, mm-hmm, or, you know, set them up for success. What is your definition of happiness, and are you living it at the moment?
So,
deep questions.
Yeah. Happiness. I think happiness is definitely within. And equally, like, success, like, no one person is going to experience 100% happiness, and no one person is going to experience 100% success. It's throughout the day. So we'll break it down into what makes me happy now is obviously seeing my son smiling. I could be in the worst mood in the world. I could be pissed off, whatever. And I see him looking at me like, come play with me.
Right.
That makes me internally happy and joyful and everything else. And then something might happen that makes me unhappy. But again, it comes down to percentages. If there's 24 hours in a day, as long as, you know, 12 hours and 1 minute you're happy, technically you're considered more so happy than you're not. I think it's just crucial managing the things that don't make you happy. As I've gotten much older, more mature, much wiser, and much more experienced in real life, everyone says, like, don't let that impact you, or don't let that, you know, have an influence on your day.
Mm.
That's all bullshit. because it's gonna, like, if you care about what you do and you're passionate about what you do, your happiness is going to be impacted more than anything, right?
Yeah.
And someone asked me the other day, actually yesterday, they asked me, they were like, well, when you were 20 years old getting started, you think you'd be in the mortgage business for 30 and 40 years? And I was like, well, are you asking me that because you've been in the business for 35 years and you definitely don't want to be in the business, but this is all you know? I would have said, yeah, I thought I would be stuck in a residential mortgage business, like shucking mortgage loans every day for the rest of my life, being miserable, making a ton of money, but being miserable and not having a life and not being happy. The fact that my ankle broke and it really showed me what was important and happiness came first, way ahead of success, I think it was super, super beneficial to understand that.
Oprah often calls certain situations like that the whisper turning into a scream. Mm-hmm. Sometimes to get our attention to invoke change in our lives, we need to have something dramatic happen. Like
most people wait until something dramatic happens. So I knew, funny, so I tried, so I started the mortgage business December 2007. It's really when I committed to doing it.
Yeah.
I truthfully committed to doing it in the spring of 2008 when I got cut from my college football team. In September of 2008, right, so not so much longer, I really tripled down and said, okay, like, now I'm really going to stop going to classes. Now I'm really going to stop, you know, going out and being distracted. Like, that lasted for about a week. And focus on mortgages, right? And that's because I made, like, 12 grand in that month in September. You know, I was 21 years old and made 12 grand. Like, this is crazy, you know? Imagine if I actually put full time into this. I then tried getting out of the business. I did get out of the business in June of 2009. So I had made, like, $118,000 in the first 6 months of 2009, and all my competition, all the old school guys, I call them dinosaurs, you know, the guys that don't like adapting.
Yeah.
Like, they were doing no deals and I was just crushing it left and right because I was breaking my ass working. Turned my phone off one day. Actually, my manager called me. I basically said, stop fucking calling me. I hope we can curse on here. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, you can edit it out if you want. I'm like, don't call me. I'm running right now. I was at the track and he thought like he owned me. He acted as if like I was like his property. And meanwhile, it's 100% commission driven business. Like, yes, you're my manager. I respect you, but you're not respecting my privacy. Like, I'm working 7 days a week. If I happen to be running at the track for this 1 hour, who are you to call me five times? Like, it's not that important. It was about something stupid. And he actually turned my phone off. He cut my phone off because it was company paid phone. So I said, oh yeah, that's what you're going to do. I literally went to the website and signed up to play Division III football in Pennsylvania. I'm like, this is enough. I'm like, I'm 22 years old. I don't deserve this. I'm miserable. Like, yeah, great. I made $118,000 in 6 months, but it's not worth this type of pressure and stress at this age. I'm like, I'm going to die by the time I'm 25. So I moved to Pennsylvania. So I got out of the mortgage business, only 18 months in, right? And wound up going, playing a couple games. I tore my rotator cuff and labrum on my left shoulder. I'm like, all right, well, I'm not living out here in Pennsylvania if I'm not playing football. So I moved back home to my mom's house for like 2 weeks, and then a buddy had called me up to come save a deal for him in the Bronx. So I put a suit and tie on, drove to the Bronx, took the application, closed the deal, and went back into the mortgage business. And then in 2012, I tried getting out again. In 2014, I tried getting out again, but something always sucked me back in.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like when my ankle broke, it really said, now is the time you have the opportunity to get out. Putting you on the couch for a reason.
Yeah.
You're no longer able to do what you're going to continuously push forward doing. And you've been successful in doing it, right? But now we're not allowing you to do that anymore. Some higher being. And that's why I was laying on the couch for 6 to 8 weeks to figure out really what I was put on this earth for.
Yeah. I love hearing stories about that too, because I think when you're in a situation, you don't really see that hindsight. Now that when you look back, you kind of know, okay, this is happening for a reason. Right. Some people, I know sometimes when I go through something, I know this is happening for a reason. I know I'm here and doing something because I'm either supposed to meet someone or learn something that's going to impact or get me to where I ever am, I'm supposed to be. So I thank you for sharing that story.
The Ginny Show. Her dream is to play Rafiki in The Lion King. That's because she acts like a baboon. The Ginny Show. We welcome you in with open arms and legs. Just arms.
In that story, like, you shared how you just kept going. You kept trying even though you broke your ankle and it really forced you to think ahead. But tell me about some of the rituals that you think people can implement to put them on the path to success daily and weekly.
I mean, the first thing is knowing yourself and knowing what you need. You know, so like the things that I really truly focus on now are health, nutrition, working out, and meditating, right? And I know if I take care of those four things, like, I didn't take care of the most important thing for a long time, and that was myself.
Right.
My brain, my heart, my body, my nutrition. I didn't, and I was still healthy. Like, you looked at me, you're like, oh yeah, this kid's in great shape. It wasn't that I was in great shape. I was working with people who were 50 years old and out of shape. Yeah. You know, I just happened to look in, and listen, I was always an athlete. So I always, like, you know, kind of looked to have the build, but I was still, like, loose and, like, still, like, didn't have as many muscles as I did playing college football and whatnot. But really focusing on, like, your four, let's say 2 to 4 things that you absolutely need in your daily basis, right? So if that's, like, stopping and getting a wheatgrass shot, or stopping and getting a protein shake every morning, or meditating before bed, or taking a CBD bath, whatever it might be, you need to make sure you incorporate those 2 to 4 things in your everyday life and build off of that. And in every single part of my life, I never set the proper foundation, other than the residential mortgage business, but I was thrown into it. I couldn't have gotten to the levels I got to and did the business I did without starting the residential mortgage business when I did, because, you know, when the market collapsed, that was the mortgage business being rewritten. So, like, my professional career and adult life was born, like, right alongside the residential mortgage business being reborn. So it happened by, like, default, not so by choice.
It's interesting that you said that too, like, the things that your priorities, your 2 to 4 things a day. I was listening to Hal Elrod's new book, The Miracle Equation, and he talks about listing out your priorities, and where people tend to fail is they want to do so many things at once. They're like, they want to have 10 goals, but they don't narrow it down to the single thing that is your single priority. So you talked about your son, how you want to kind of be there for him at the start of the day and the end of his day. And Hal was talking about the same thing. It's his kids. He wants to do his morning practice, wake them up, pick them up 3 times a week at school, have a day with them. So he really focuses on what's really important to him. So I think, you know, what you just mentioned there, I mean, you mentioned 2 to 4 things that you can put into your day, which I think is really important. But I think the best thing to do is start with one and then implement the 2 to 4
and people, and I think, and what I see is, and I've 100% been guilty of this, is people all start with the wrong thing.
Yeah.
So if you ask me, you know, what are the reasons you stayed in the mortgage business so long, when you knew in June of 2009, when you still had a chance to maintain your hairline, to get out of the business, why didn't you? In fact, 2 factors. The money. Like, where am I going to go and make this money? I just killed myself for 18 months. And I mean, 18 to 19 months of sacrifice, killed myself. Like, ground and pound, sweat, blood, tears, everything. Like, I'm going to have nothing to show for it, which wasn't true, because I proved to myself and everyone else I could do it. And the third thing was the accountability to my relationships, right? So because mortgage people have a bad reputation, there are some good ones out there. And because the market was changing drastically and not a lot of banks could do deals, no one really knew how to do the business, everyone was discouraged. I felt like it was my to not let these people down. I mean, I kept all my old phones. So at one point in 2013, I had 4 phones. I had a 718 number, a New Jersey number, a 212 number, and a Westchester, New York number. Because in the mortgage business, if you deal with somebody, they kind of want to see, like, you're local to them. So depending on the territory that I was actively ground and pound attacking, I would be like, hey, here's my number, 914. Here's my number, Manhattan, 212. Like, right. Here's New Jersey, 201, whatever it was. And it was just like, if I don't get these deals closed, they're not going to get a commission. And because deals are so scarce to close on the purchase side in that time frame, I really just didn't want to let people down. And I did it for all the right reasons. Money wasn't the right reason, but that's offset by the fact that I didn't want to let people down that put their trust in me and also put their, you know, livelihood in me.
I guess when you work on commission too, Jeff, what I've kind of found too is it's being an entrepreneur too, because you being an entrepreneur, you may be always working, but you're not always getting paid. And
I work a lot of days when I get paid.
Exactly. Yeah. But you're constantly working. Mm-hmm. Where do you think entrepreneurship is going these days? You think it'll be something that will continue, or do you think there's going to be a day where we're like, all right, this is just going to stop for a little bit?
That's a good question, right? So let's deposit that.
Yeah.
So in 2013, I got linked up with an early WeWork company. Not WeWork, but same concept, co-working space. Now, remember, all I knew in adult life, I literally knew football to residential mortgages. I didn't even really know real estate. I obviously learned and taught myself real estate as I was closing, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of mortgages. I finally broke into Manhattan. A girl who I had gone to night class with at Fordham sent me a message on, I think, on LinkedIn. Because, like, LinkedIn, like, was the only, like, professional way to reach out to somebody back then. Like, you weren't going to, like, DM somebody. I definitely didn't have Instagram in 2013. I was late to the game on that. And she said, hey, I just started becoming a realtor. I just started working for this new real estate startup. At that time, I didn't even know what a startup was, right? The only person that I ever knew to be an entrepreneur was my partner at the time, Mario Costanz, who's now opened up, I think, his, like, 12th or 15th company. He's now the CEO of Happy Tax. And he's a guy that was always like a big brother to me. Always looked out for me. We made a lot of money together. We lost a good amount of money together. That's just business in general. When I say lost, you know, we made a lot of money, but we put it back into businesses and never got it back out. So we really didn't lose it. You know, once you have it and you put it back in, you lose it, I guess. Yeah. So we lost money together.
Right, right.
But we made a lot of money too. Go into Manhattan. Now I'm 26 years old. I'm fearful of Manhattan, limiting beliefs, right? And I'm like, I can't play Manhattan. Like, I know the Bronx. I know mortgages, but I don't know Manhattan. I've been to Manhattan a couple times to party and hang out. I drove to Manhattan one day in 2008 when I had to go to, you know, Russell Simmons.
Yeah.
So I did a loan for Russell Simmons, personal assistant. I was, like, so fearful. I put the address in my navigation. I literally parked illegally because I didn't know where to park. I didn't know where I was going. I ran upstairs. I got, like, two tickets, whatever. So I'm like, I don't know Manhattan. And I sat down with a guy who ran the company. And I sat down with the girl who introduced us. And me and this guy just hit it off. He actually became one of my partners in my commercial mortgage brokerage and advisory firm. I took him out of that real estate business and brought him into the money side and brokerage side for money. And I'm like, what is this concept here? They're like, yeah, we have a co-working space. I'm like, what the hell is a co-working space? This is 2013. So
right. It's fairly new.
Yeah. And they definitely didn't have co-working spaces in the Bronx. They called them like co-mingling spaces where you had like a real estate office, a mortgage guy, a tax office, right. A lawyer, like one-stop shop is what I knew it.
Right.
The original co-working space was called a one-stop shop, right? That's what it was. So I'm sitting there and I'm like, okay, well, explain to me how this is. Like, oh, this girl's making protein waffles. This person's an architect. This person's an attorney. And I'm like, wait, these are all the people on your team? They're like, no. They're like, they rent desk space from us. I'm like, wow. I'm like, it's a pretty cool concept. And everyone I met that day, yeah, I'm an entrepreneur. Yeah, I'm an entrepreneur. Yeah, I'm an entrepreneur. Yeah, I just had my startup. Yeah, I just opened up my business, right? And I'm like, man, I'm late. I'm stupid. I thought I was stupid, truthfully. I'm like, I've never heard of the term startup before. And then we started having these seminars where I would come in and speak about mortgages and real estate, how to get started and whatnot. And I had all their ears. They were like listening to me, looking up at me as like I was speaking a different language to them. Meanwhile, again, because I didn't know, I'm like, man, these people must be killing it. Like they have an office in Manhattan. They're making a ton of money. And as I progressed along that relationship, I'm giving an example. Joe was no longer there. Ashley was no longer there. Bill was no longer there. And I'm like, hey, where's Joe? he closed his business down. Oh, where's Ashley? Oh, she went back to her 9-to-5. Where's Bill? Bill decided to work from home, right? And before I knew it, all these people were like aspiring to start their own business, right? Meanwhile, they didn't have the experience.
Right.
I commend them for taking the shot at it, but they clearly didn't plan well or things didn't go as they had planned,
yeah.
Right? And
that's
part of the trials and tribulations.
Right.
After my long-winded answer to get back to my thesis around this is entrepreneurship will always be there and has always been there, right? I think most people enter entrepreneurship way too early in life with not enough experience. They didn't get their ass kicked. They don't appreciate the freedom. They can't manage their time properly. They don't account for enough money and they're not willing to sacrifice their lifestyle once they leave the 9-to-5 making $100,000 a year in order to say, hey, I know I'm not going to make money for 12 months or 18 months. You might make profit. You might make money, but you got bills, right? So again, Gary says it all the time. I've never met him. I'm going to meet him soon. I have a feeling. But people want to be him. They think because he did it, it's easy, right? People looked at me like, oh, well, if Jeff made $500,000 in the mortgage business at 24, I can make $250. Well, you don't know what I did to put into it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And the fact that it's cool, I would say if something seems to be cool, most people probably aren't making money doing it. Because usually how I look at cool, like if it's cool, this is happy, this is a passion thing, there's probably, now you might be lucky to make a ton of money off of it. You hit it big, that one thing, right? But 99% of people fail in that. And I met with a girl yesterday who worked for Blinds to Go for 7 years. It's actually funny. She was driving home one day, working Blinds to Go, 9-to-5. And she got pulled over in 2013. And it was by ICE. And she was here illegally.
Wow.
She was here legally, but illegally. You know,
right.
The whole thing.
Yeah.
Which, I'm not political, but everyone says Trump is part of ICE. Clinton was originally, way back in the day, and Obama was in house. So hearing her tell this story, I think she is Cuban, or her father's Peruvian. So not from here.
Mm-hmm.
You should hear her tell the story. I'm going to have her on my show. And she's like, it's the best thing that happened to me because I realized that day that my future was in someone else's hands. So I'm like, well, what do you mean by that? She's like, Blinds to Go fired me because I couldn't work here legally. So my only other option was to open up my own business. And that's why I opened up my restaurant. And this is my 7th year and we're hitting record numbers each month.
Wow.
So going back to the lesson of that, was she like doing her 9 to 5 at Blinds to Go, made $100,000+ a year, right?
Right.
But a life altering event caused her to really find her passion, and now she's on her third restaurant. So she had the experience. She was willing to sacrifice, and she had no other option because she couldn't work legally.
Absolutely.
And someone like that doesn't have that buffer to like sink or swim, if you will.
Yeah.
They have to swim because you have no other option, right? And that comes down to people having like the right pride and the right reason for it. I think everyone has a great idea. There's 10 trillion ideas out there, but it's about executing it and realizing it that like the success rate is so small, you should really not go into entrepreneurship as your full-time thing without having your 9 to 5 really solidified and funding it. Use your 9 to 5 to fund your entrepreneurship.
That's how I started too. My 9 to 4 wasn't 9 to 5. It was technically my 9 to 5 job, but it was like I worked 2:30 to 11 every day. That funded my Ginny Media startup for 2 years, and then I could leave it eventually.
That's smart. That's the best way of doing it.
Well, it's also a way to, what was great for me when I was working in manufacturing, we were constructing airplane wings for the 787 plane. So a little bit different than media, but also for me, I found that worked for me because it was so different to what I loved. So it was enough to keep me there and present to make money, obviously, to fund my passions. Mm-hmm. But it also was good because I didn't have to take work home. Some people do 9 to 5, but it's never 9 to 5. They have to take work home with them.
And if it's not physically, it's mentally.
Exactly. In one way or another. So for me, it was good. I just clock on, clock off. I made my money. I could go home, or even sometimes.
I've never had that. How is that?
In terms of stimulation, it wasn't
fun.
The best. But in terms of like, a way to make money easily and gracefully, that was perfect for me. So I think if you're blessed enough to have a job like that where you can clock on, clock off, don't have to take your worries home with you. I never had to worry about, oh, did I finish? Because I knew everything I had to do from, it was very automated. It was very structured. The processes of.
Sounds nice. I'm going to try that one day. I've never been to start at all.
Exactly. Yeah. But the processes of you know, doing it was quite easy. But the advice that you touched on there, Jeff, was great because I think looking at your 9 to 5 differently, a lot of people are having the conversation about, okay, how do you be an entrepreneur and build your own business? But really think about it in the context of your 9 to 5 and what you're doing now. How can that be a stepping stone?
I would say that the number one way to find out if someone truly loves their job is by not asking for more money. So when I hear someone saying, I'm not making enough money or I need a raise, I'm like, well, you're saying that because you think it's going to make your job more better or enjoyable. Or you're going to actually find passion, get more money for it. So the key indicator of actually figuring out if somebody loves their job or not is if whether or not they're complaining they need a raise or not.
Also how they value their time, really. Because if you're putting in all that time and you're not getting monetized or some form of reward for it, the thing is, entrepreneurs, we put in a lot of time that we don't get monetized
for. You know what the best experience, one of the most valuable experiences I've gotten at an early age was I used to run my own profit and loss for banks, right? So I worked for a bank, but I ran it as if I ran my own bank inside of their bank. I basically just used their licensing and operations, right? But I saw where every penny went, right? And in my heyday, I was spending, me personally, $3,000 a month in credit reports alone. I was pulling 150 to 200 credit reports per month for leads. You know, here's a pre-approval, here you got to get a credit report or whatever. So spending $30,000 a year on credit reports alone, you know, you could hire somebody for that, right?
Yeah.
That's a salary right there.
Absolutely.
You know, paying a processor $70,000, $80,000. And then, it's great, $70,000. But then you have payroll tax, right?
Yeah.
And then you have to pay rent. And then you have to pay utilities. And then at the bottom line, you're like, well, what's left for me? And getting that experience of really seeing what companies, banks, at the end of the day, profit and losses for any business, right? Where the money goes, how much money is left over at the end of the day. You know, it gives you a real appreciation for like, you know, $5. So like if your boss is fortunate enough to give you health insurance or pay a portion of it, you should be grateful, not say he should pay all of it. Or, you know, if they give you a 401k match or contribution, you should be grateful, not say, oh, well, they don't match enough or they only match 3%. Because if you're sitting on the other side and you know what the bottom line is, you know, maybe that's all they have to give.
Yeah.
And you know what? CEOs and like big companies get like a bad rap. Oh, this guy makes $1 million a year. But if he's a CEO of the company, he might be traveling, flying on private planes, golfing, whenever. Mentally, he's on 24/7. So when you actually factor in 365 days of the year, 24 hours a day, when you break that down by the hour, I'm actually going to do that for everybody.
Yeah.
So if you have, let's say, 365 days times 24 hours, right? That's 8,760 minutes, right?
Yeah.
Hours. No, it's hours in a year, right? 8,760 hours. So you do the math, even if it's getting paid, you know, $100 an hour, right? That puts you at $876,000 a year. So I know, like, when I ran my mortgage business, this is a fact. I did not sleep until I broke my ankle.
Wow.
I didn't sleep. Why? Because I usually carried like 15 to 30 loans for consumers in my pipeline at any given time. That means that they're actively applying for a mortgage, buying a home, refinancing, right? 15 to 30, big number. I talk to usually every one of those every single day throughout the entire process. And if you can squeeze, the average person doesn't talk to 15 people in a day, let alone you need to provide them a service. So every time I would go to sleep, I would be in the middle of texting or replying to an email. As soon as I'd wake up in the middle of the night to grab a glass of water or whatever, use the bathroom, I would obviously check my texts or emails. So my phone was nonstop. I didn't disconnect for that 10-year period. If you make $800,000, $900,000 a year as a CEO, you deserve that plus more because, you know, you don't have that mental peace. You don't have that mental sanity. And people knock that. You know, at the end of the day, even if you make $1 million a year, you're only bringing home $500,000 or $600,000.
Yeah.
So you're really working for less.
Yeah. What you're getting paid for is that lack of peace of mind, which is such a high cost. Jeff, we could sit here talking for ages, but I've loved having you on the Ginny Show, and thank you for sharing such a unique story and you know, a unique perspective on happiness and that. So I really appreciate your time
today.
Thank
you for
having me. So thank you for being here. We'll have to have you back on because I'm sure there's more. It's only tip of the iceberg we touched. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you. The Ginny Show.